Corrus looked up to see a long stone quay looming up close at hand. The tide had turned long enough ago to leave the high-water garland of weed and shellfish a good foot and a half clear of the harbor, and the launch slid alongside a set of stone steps leading down into the sea. The two or three lowest of the exposed steps looked decidedly treacherous, covered with a slushy mix of residual seawater and falling snow, where they weren't still regularly sloshed over by the weary-looking swell. But the upper steps didn't look a lot better. There'd been enough traffic to pack the snow into ice, and it didn't look as if anyone had spread fresh sand across them in the last several hours.
"Mind the footing, my lord,"
the coxswain warned, and Corrus nodded in acknowledgement. He also reached into his purse to add an extra quarter mark to the boat crew's tip. That was probably exactly what the coxswain had hoped would happen, and the Earl knew it, but that didn't change his gratitude for the reminder.
"And you mind your footing too, Robert," he tossed over his shoulder, as he stood and stepped cautiously onto solid stone for the first time in a month.
The solid stone in question seemed to be curtsying and dipping underfoot, and he grimaced at the sensation. That wasn't going to help him get up these damn stairs undrenched, undrowned, and unfractured, he reflected glumly.
"I don't want to be fishing you or the baggage out of the damned harbor," he added, as one of the launch's oarsmen helped the valet move Corrus's carefully balanced trunk.
"If it's all the same to you, my lord, I'd just as soon you didn't have to either," Sea Blanket replied,
and Corrus snorted, took a firm and grateful grip on the hand rope rigged through eye bolts set into the side of the quay to serve as a railing, and made his way carefully up the slippery steps. He inhaled in relief as he finally reached the quay's broad, flat surface intact. Everything still seemed to be moving under his feet, and he wondered how long it was going to take him to regain his land legs this time. Given how extended and lively the passage across the gulf had been, he wouldn't be surprised if it took considerably longer than usual. He stepped away from the head of the stair, trying not to move too gingerly across the apparently swaying quay, then turned to watch Sea Blanket and one of the launch's oarsmen carrying the baggage cautiously up. The valet's expression was even more lugubrious than usual, and his long nose, red with cold, seemed to quiver as if he could actually smell some sort of accident or dropped trunk stealing surreptitiously closer under cover of the veiling snow. Despite any trepidation Sea Blanket might have felt, however, Corrus's trunks and valises made the hazardous journey up onto the quay unambushed by disaster. Sea Blanket had just clambered back down the slippery steps after his own, more modest traveling bag when someone cleared his throat behind the Earl. He found himself facing a man wearing the blue-trimmed brown cassock of an underpriest of the Order of Chihiro under a thick, obviously warm coat. The priest seemed on the young side for his clerical rank, and although he was actually only very slightly above average in height, he also seemed somehow just a bit larger than life. The badge of Chihiro's quill on the left shoulder of his coat was crossed with a sheathed sword, further identifying him as a member of the Order of the Sword. Chihiro's order was unique in being divided into two sub-orders, the Order of the Sword, which produced a high percentage of the Temple Guard's officers, and the Order of the Quill, which produced an almost equally high percentage of the church's clerks and bureaucrats. Corrus rather doubted, given this fellow's obviously muscular physique and the calluses on the fingers of his sword hand, that anyone really needed the shoulder badge to know which aspect of Chihiro's order he served.
"Earl Corrus?" the underpriest inquired in a courteous voice.
"Yes, father," Corrus replied.
He bowed in polite acknowledgement, hoping his face didn't show his dismay. Having someone pop up clear down here at quayside in the middle of a snowfall on a freezing cold day when no one could possibly have known Snow Lizard would choose today for her arrival, did not strike him as a good sign. Or not, at least, where his hope of spending a day or two in a snug warm room was concerned. "I'm Father Hollis Tanner, my lord," the underpriest told him. "I've been waiting for you for several days now."
"I'm afraid the weather was less than cooperative," Corus began, and...
"Please, my lord," Tanner smiled quickly. "That wasn't a complaint, I assure you. In fact, I know Captain Euthane quite well, and I'm confident he got you here as swiftly as humanly possible. In fact, given what I expect the weather was like, he made rather better time than I expected, even from him." "No, no," he shook his head. "I wasn't complaining about any tardiness on your part, my lord. Simply introducing myself as the fellow responsible for seeing you through the next, undoubtedly unpleasant leg of your journey."
"I see."
Corus considered the underpriest for a moment. Tanner couldn't be more than 35, he decided, and probably not quite that old. He was dark-haired and brown-eyed, with a swarthy complexion and the lean, lively features of a man who would never find it difficult to attract female companionship. There was what looked suspiciously like humor dancing in the depths of those eyes, and even simply standing motionless in the snow, he seemed to radiate an abundance of energy. And competence, the Earl decided.
"Well, Father Hollis," he said after a handful of seconds, "since you've been so forthright, I won't pretend I'm looking forward to the rigors of our trip, shall we say?"
"Nor should you be," Tanner told him cheerfully. "The bad news is that it's the better part of 1,300 miles as the wyvern flies from here to Lakeview, and we're not wyverns. It's a bit better than 1,700 by road, and what with snow, ice, and the Wishbone Mountains squarely in the way, it's going to take us very nearly a month just to get there. At least the high road follows the Raworth Valley, so we won't have to spend all our time climbing up and down. And I've arranged for relays of snow lizards to be waiting at the church posthouses all along our route, so we'll make fair time, I imagine, as long as we're not actively weatherbound. But even the valley's a good 700 or 800 feet higher than Fairstock, so I think we can safely assume the weather's going to be miserable enough to keep us off the roads for at least the equivalent of a 5 day or so, anyway."
"You make it sound delightful, Father," Corus said dryly, and Tanner laughed.
"The writ says truth is always better than lies, my lord, and trying to convince ourselves it'll be better than we know it will isn't going to make us any happier when we're stuck in some miserable little village inn in the Wishbones waiting for a blizzard to pass, now is it?"
"No, I don't imagine it is," Corus agreed.
And after all, it wasn't as if Tanner were telling him anything he hadn't already realized. "The good news, such as it is," Tanner said, "is that I think you'll be in for a bit of a treat once we finally do get to Lakeside."
"Indeed,"
Corus cocked his head, and Tanner nodded. "It's been a hard winter, my lord, and according to the semaphore, the lake's already frozen pretty hard. By the time we get there, we won't have to worry about hitting any open water on our way across." "Well," he corrected himself with a judicious air, which was only slightly undermined by the twinkle in his eyes. "We probably won't have to worry about it. You can never be entirely certain when a lead's going to open up unexpectedly."
"So we definitely will be taking an ice boat from Lakeview to Zion?"
Corus shook his head just a bit doubtfully.
"I've been to sea often enough, but I've never gone ice sailing."
"That we will, and I think you'll find the experience interesting," Tanner assured him. The underpriest had obviously noticed Corus's mixed feelings, and he smiled again. "Most people do, especially the first time they make the trip. Hornet's quite a bit smaller than Snow Lizard, of course, but she's much faster if I do say so myself."
"Ah?" Corus cocked an eyebrow. "That sounded rather possessive, Father. Should I take it you're going to be my captain across the lake, as well as shepherding me safely from here to Lakeview?"
"Indeed, my lord," Tanner gave him a sort of sketchy half-bow. "And I can assure you that I have never, yet, lost a passenger during a winter passage."
And I assure you that I am suitably comforted by your reassurance, Father, even if it did seem to contain at least a hint of qualification.
Tanner's smile became a grin, and Corus felt himself relaxing a bit more. He still wasn't looking forward to the journey, but Hollis Tanner was about as far as anyone could have gotten from the grimly focused Schulerite keeper he'd expected to encounter for the final stage of his journey.
"Seriously, my lord," Tanner continued, "Hornet is much faster than you may have been assuming. She doesn't have a galley's hull drag, so the same wind will push her a lot faster, and the prevailing winds will be in our favor this time of year. Not to mention the fact that we're far enough into the winter now that the ice has been pretty well charted and marked, so I can afford to give her more of her head than I could earlier in the year. I won't be surprised if we average as much as 30 miles an hour during the lake crossing itself."
"Really?"
Despite himself, Corus couldn't hide how impressed he was by the speed estimate, or by the fact that it radically revised downward his original estimate of how long it would take to cross Lake Pei.
Of course, that was a two-edged sword. It meant he'd spend less time shivering and miserable on the ice, but it also meant he'd be meeting with Chancellor Trinair and the Grand Inquisitor that much more quickly as well. And it wasn't going to make the month-long journey from Fairstock to Lakeview any less arduous than the underpriest had already promised.
"I suppose I should spend some time thanking Langhorne I'm still young enough to have a realistic prospect of surviving the experience," he thought sourly.
"Really, my lord," Tanner assured him, answering his last question. "In fact, running with the wind in a good lake blizzard, I've had her up to better than 50 miles per hour. That's average speed over a 20-mile course, too. So I'm sure we were higher than that, at least in bursts, on more than one occasion. I'll try not to inflict any weather quite that spectacular on you this time around. It's not exactly something for the faint of heart, or, as my mother would put it, for the reasonably sane," he winked. "Still, I think I can promise you'll find the crossing memorable."
The underpriest smiled with obvious pride in his vessel, then turned his head, watching Sea Blanket emerge onto the quay once more with the final piece of baggage. He gazed at the valet with a thoughtful expression for several seconds, then looked back at Corus, and there was an almost conspiratorial gleam in his eye.
"I realize, my lord, that you undoubtedly wish to complete your journey as quickly as possible. I have no doubt your impatience to set forth again is greater than ever, in light of the current inclement weather and the obviously strenuous nature of the voyage you've just completed. I'm afraid, however, that I'm not entirely satisfied with the lizard team reserved for the first leg of our journey. Not only that, but I've been having a few second thoughts about our planned stopping points along the way. I've come to the conclusion that the entire trip could have been a bit better planned and coordinated. And I think we'll probably complete it more quickly in the long run if I spend a little time tweaking my present arrangements. I apologize profusely for the delay, but as the person charged with delivering you safe and sound, I really wouldn't feel comfortable setting out on a journey as long as this one without first making certain all of our arrangements are going to be as problem-free as possible."
"Well, we certainly couldn't have you feeling pressured into anything precipitous, Father," Corus replied, making no effort to hide his sudden gratitude, "and certainly prepared to defer to your professional judgment. We can't have you skimping on your preparations if you feel any of them could stand improvement, now can we? By all means, see to it before we set out."
"I appreciate your willingness to be so understanding, my lord. Assuming the weather gives us a window for the semaphore, I expect tidying things up should take no more than, oh..."
Tanner looked at the Earl consideringly, like an assayer, almost as if he could physically measure Corus's fatigue.
"A day or two, possibly three. In fact, we'd better count on three. So I'm afraid you're probably going to have to spend at least 4 nights here in Fairstock. I hope that won't disappoint you too deeply."
"Believe me, Father," Corus said, looking him in the eye, "I believe I'll manage to bear up under my disappointment."
6. HMS Destiny, 54, off Hennet Head, Gulf of Matthias. Someone from the planet Humanity had once called Earth might have described it as 4-6 from the old Beaufort scale. Ensign Hector Aplin Armok, the Duke of Darkos, had never heard of the Beaufort scale, but he had been at sea for almost 5 of his 14 years. Well, 13 years and 9 months, since his birthday was next month. And to his experienced eye, the 11-foot waves, with their white foamy crests, and the high humming sound whining through the stays, were the product of what a seaman would have called either a strong breeze or a stiff topsail breeze, which still had another 4 or 5 miles per hour to go before it officially became a near gale. Hector suspected that most landsmen would have found the ship's motion, the way she leaned to her canvas, and the flying spray bursting up around her cutwater as she drove hard, rising in showers of diamonds when the early morning sun caught it, alarming. In fact, there'd been a time, though he couldn't really remember it now, when he would have found it distinctly so. Now, though, he found it exhilarating, especially with his stomach so freshly wrapped around a breakfast of toasted biscuit and well-sweetened raisin-laced oatmeal, despite the sharp, icy teeth of the wind. And he clapped his gloved hands together and beamed hugely as he looked up at the reefed topsails and topgallants, then turned to the senior of the two men on the wheel. "How does she feel, Chief?" he asked.
"Well enough, sir."
Chief Petty Officer Franklin Wigan was closing in on 3 times the youthful ensign's age, and Hector was about as junior as an officer got. Once upon a time, all of 3 or 4 months ago, he would have been referred to not as an ensign, but as a past midshipman, a midshipman who had successfully sat his lieutenant's examination but not yet received his commission, since he legally couldn't be granted a full lieutenant's commission until he was at least 16 years old. The new ensign rank had been introduced as part of the Navy's enormous expansion, and the fleet was still in the process of getting used to it. But if Wigan felt any exasperation at being interrogated by an officer of Ensign Aplin Armok's tender years and lack of seniority, he showed no sign of it.
"She's taken a bit more weather elm nor I'd like," Wigan added, "but not so much as all that."
Hector nodded. Any sailing vessel carried at least a little weather helm when she came close to the wind, and at the moment Destiny was close reaching to the east-northeast on the starboard tack under single reefed topgallants and topsails, with the wind out of the south-southeast, just over 3 points abaft the beam. That was very close to close-hauled for HMS Destiny. Hector doubted they could have edged more than another point or so closer to the wind, and damned few other square riggers could have come this close. Of course, it made for a lively ride, but that was part of the exhilaration, and even with her reduced sail, the ship had to be making good close to 7 knots. Well, over 6.5 at least. That was an excellent turn of speed, although she could probably have carried more sail and shown a little more speed if Captain Yearly had decided to shake out the topgallant reefs and press her. "Not that he's likely to do anything of the sort without a damn good reason," Hector thought with a small inner smile. "It would never suit his fussy worrier's image." The truth was that Hector recognized just how fortunate he'd been to be assigned to Yearly's command in the first place, and not just because of the captain's abilities as a mentor in tactics and seamanship either. Hector doubted there could have been a better teacher in the entire fleet for either of those skills. Yet, as appreciative as he was of that training, he was even more grateful for the time Yearly had taken to teach one Hector Aplin Armok certain other equally essential skills. Despite his present exalted patent of nobility, Hector Aplin had most definitely not been born to the aristocracy. His was a family of sturdy, hard-working merchant seamen, and young Hector's appointment as a midshipman in the Royal Carisian Navy had represented a significant step upward for the Aplins. He'd hoped to make a decent career for himself. The Carisian Navy was really the only one on Safehold where a commoner had an excellent chance of rising to even the highest ranks, and more than one man as commonly born as he had ended up with a knighthood and an admiral's streamer when all was said. He could think of at least a half dozen who'd earned baronetcies, and at least one who'd died an earl for that matter. But he'd never dreamed for a moment that he might end up a duke. Then again, his amusement dimmed. He'd never expected to have his king die in his arms, or to live with the knowledge that his monarch had received his fatal wound, fighting to protect him. Never anticipated that he would be one of only 36 survivors of the entire crew of King Harald VII's flagship. In fact, three of those survivors had eventually died of their wounds in the end, after all, despite all the healers could do, and of the 33 who hadn't, 11 had been so badly wounded they would never go to sea again. The odds that he might simply have survived that level of carnage, far less remained on active duty after it, would have struck him as tiny enough on their own. The possibility of his being adopted into the House of Armagh, of becoming legally the son of Emperor Caleb himself, would never have occurred to him in the wildest delirium. And if anyone had ever suggested the possibility to him, he would have run screaming in terror from the prospect. What could he, the son of a merchant galleon's first officer, possibly have in common with the royal family? The very idea was absurd. Unfortunately, it had happened. Probably, in the fullness of time, Hector was going to come to consider that a good thing. He was perfectly prepared to admit the possibility. He wasn't stupid, after all. But his immediate reaction had been one of abject panic, which was why he was so grateful he'd wound up in Destiny. Sir Duncan Yearley was scarcely from the rarefied heights of the nobility himself, but he was at least related, albeit distantly, to three barons and an earl. More to the point, he'd taken pains from the outset to personally instruct young midshipman Aplin Armagh in the etiquette which went with his towering new aristocratic rank. "Starting with which fork to use," Hector reflected, grinning again as he remembered how the captain had rapped him sharply across the knuckles with his own fork when he reached for the wrong one. "I thought sure he'd broken them, but I suppose..."
"Sail ho!"
The hail came down from the lookout perched in the mainmast crosstrees, 110 feet above the deck. From there, the horizon was almost 11.5 miles farther away than it was from deck level, and on a clear day like today, he could undoubtedly see that far.
"Two sail, 5 points to larboard,"
the lookout amplified a moment later.
"Master Aplin Armagh," a closer, deeper voice said,
and Hector turned to find himself facing Lieutenant Robert Lathic, Destiny's first lieutenant who had the watch.
"Aye, sir."
Hector touched his chest with his right fist in salute. Lathic was a tall man, tall enough he had to mind his head constantly under the ship's deck beams, and he had a short way with slackers. He insisted on proper military courtesy at all times, especially out of extremely junior officers. But he was also a fine seaman, and he didn't, usually, go out of his way to find fault.
"Get aloft, Master Aplin Armagh," Lathic said now, handing him the watch spyglass. "See what you can tell us about these fellows."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Hector seized the telescope, slung its carrying strap over his shoulder, and leapt nimbly for the ratlines. Lathic could easily have sent one of the galleon's midshipmen, but Hector was glad he hadn't. One of the things he missed, thanks to his recent promotion and appointment as Destiny's acting fifth lieutenant, was that no lieutenant, not even one who was really a lowly ensign, was allowed to race his fellows up and down the rigging the way mere midshipmen could. Unlike many of his fellows, Hector had been born with an excellent head for heights.
He'd loved spending time in the tops, and laying out along the yard, even in the roughest weather, had never truly bothered him. Scared him sometimes, yes, but always with that edge of exhilaration to keep the terror company. And now he went scampering up the humming weather shrouds like a monkey lizard. He ignored the lubber's hole when he reached the maintop, hanging from his fingers and toes as he climbed the futtock shrouds around the top instead, then swarmed on up the topmast shrouds. Wind whistled chill around his ears and burned cold in his lungs, and his eyes were bright with pleasure as the shrill whistle of one of the sea wyverns following the ship, perpetually hopeful of snapping up some tasty tidbit of garbage, floated to him.
"Where away, Jackson?"
he asked the lookout as he reached the sailor's dizzying roost. The lookout was perched on the crosstrees, one leg dangling nonchalantly between the weatherhounds, one arm wrapped around the foot of the topgallant mast, and he grinned as his eyes met Hector's. It was colder up here, and the wind always grew fresher as one climbed higher above the deck. That much was a known fact, although Hector had no idea why it should be so. Despite the exertion of his climb, he was grateful for his thick watch coat, heavy gloves, and the soft knitted muffler Princess Jeannette had given him last midwinter day. The main topmast head was almost a foot and a half in diameter, where its upper end passed through the cap above the crosstrees, which helped support the topgallant mast, and it shivered against his spine as he leaned back against it, vibrating like a living thing with the force of wind and wave. When he looked straight down, he saw not Destiny's deck, but the gray-green and white water creaming away from her leeward side as she leaned to the press of her canvas. If he fell from his present position, he'd hit water, not planking. Not that it would make much difference. As cold as that water was, his chances of surviving long enough for anyone aboard ship to do anything to save him would be effectively non-existent. Fortunately, he had no intention of doing anything of the sort.
"There, sir," the lookout said and pointed.
Hector followed the pointing finger, nodded, and hooked one knee securely around the topmast head as he used both gloved hands to raise the heavy telescope and peered through it. Steadying something the size of a powerful telescope, especially while one swept through a dizzying arc with the ship's motion, was not a task to be lightly undertaken. The fact that Hector would never be a large, powerfully built man like Lathic didn't make it any easier either. On the other hand, his slender boy's frame was filling out steadily into a well-muscled wiriness, and he'd had lots of practice. He supported the tube on his left forearm, swinging it through a compensating arc, and captured the pale flaw of the distant ship's topsails with a steadiness a landsman would have found difficult to credit. Even from here, the ships to whom those sails belonged remained hull down. He could see only their topsails fully, although the tops of their main courses came into sight when both they and Destiny happened to rise simultaneously. Assuming their masts were the same length as Destiny's, which would put their main yards about 50 feet above the water, that made them about 14.5 miles distant. He studied them carefully, patiently, evaluating their course and trying to get some feel for their speed. His eye ached as he stared through the spyglass, but he neither blinked nor lowered the glass until he was satisfied. Then he sighed in relief, let the glass come back to hang from its shoulder strap once more, and rubbed his eye.
"What do you make of 'em, sir?" the seaman asked.
Hector turned his head to arch one eyebrow at him, and the sailor grinned. It was unlikely, to say the least, that he would have been forward enough to pose the same question to Lieutenant Lathic, and Hector knew some of his fellow officers. Lieutenant Garaith Simke, Destiny's second lieutenant, came rather forcibly to mind, would have been quick to depress the man's pretension. For that matter, he supposed a mere ensign had even more reason than most to be sure he guarded his authority against overfamiliarity from the men he commanded. Captain Yearly, on the other hand,
who never seemed to have any particular difficulty maintaining his authority, would simply have answered the question, and if it was good enough for the captain...
Well, Hector said, it's still a bit far away to be making out details, even with the glass, but unless I'm mistaken, at least the nearer of them is flying a church pennant.
You don't say, sir.
Jackson's grin grew considerably broader. He actually rubbed his hands together in anticipation, since the presence of the church pennant automatically made the ship flying it a legitimate prize, waiting to be taken, and Hector grinned back at him. Then the ensign allowed his smile to fade into a more serious expression.
You did well to spot them, Jackson, he said, patting the older man, although, to be fair, Jackson was only in his late 20s.
Top men were generally chosen from the youngest and fittest members of a ship's company. On the shoulder.
Thank ye, sir.
Jackson was positively beaming now, and Hector nodded to him, then reached for the shrouds once more. He was strongly tempted to slide down the backstay, but the youthful exuberance of his midshipman's days was behind him now. Lieutenant Lathick had made that point rather firmly just last 5 day, and so he descended in a more leisurely fashion.
Well, Master Aplin Armok, the first lieutenant inquired, as he reached the ship's rail, hopped down onto the deck, and made his way aft once more.
There are definitely two of them, sir, that we can see so far at any rate. Galleons, ship-rigged, but not as lofty as we are, I think. They aren't carrying royal masts anyway. I make the range about 14 or 15 miles, and they're sailing on the wind, almost exactly northwest by north. They're showing their courses and topsails, but not their topgallants, and I think the closer of the two is flying a church pennant.
Is she now? Lathick mused.
Yes, sir, and as she lifted, I could just catch a glimpse of her mizzen. I couldn't see her head sails, so I can't say for sure that she's got the new jibs, but she's definitely got a gaff spanker. She's wearing new canvas, too. It's hardly weathered at all, and I think she's big, sir. I'd be surprised if she were a lot smaller than we are.
Lathick's eyes narrowed, and Hector could almost feel him following the same logic chain Hector had already explored. Then the first lieutenant nodded ever so slightly and turned to one of the midshipmen hovering nearby.
My respects to the captain, Master Jones, and inform him that we have sighted two galleons bearing almost due north, distance about 14 miles, running northwest by north. And Master Aplin Armok,
the first lieutenant smiled slightly at Hector,
is firmly of the opinion that at least one of them is a large, newly rigged galleon in the service of the church.
Aye, aye, sir,
young Jones squeaked. He couldn't have been more than 12 years old, which struck Hector as absurdly young, despite the fact that he himself had been at sea for 3 years by the time he'd been that age. The midshipman started for the hatch at a semi-run, then froze as Lathick cleared his throat loudly enough to be heard even over the sounds of wind and wave. The boy peered at him for a second, huge-eyed, then hastily straightened and came to attention.
"Beg pardon, sir," he said,
and then repeated Lathick's message word for word.
"Very good, Master Jones," Lathick confirmed with a nod when he'd finished,
and the midshipman darted away again. Hector watched him go and remembered a time when he'd garbled a message, and not to any mere master-after-God captain, either. He'd been positive he was going to die of humiliation right on the spot. And, assuming he'd survived that, he'd known Captain Trevithan would give him the look, which would be considerably worse when he heard about the transgression.
I suppose it was just as well, the ensign reminded himself, managing not to smile as Jones disappeared down the main hatch, that His Majesty forgave me after all.
So, Rusail, what do you make of her?
Commodore Wailar inquired as he stepped out from under the break of the poop deck, and Captain Rusail Abbott, commanding officer of the Imperial Desnarian Navy Galleon Archangel Chihiro, turned quickly to face him.
Beg your pardon, Sir Hiram, the captain saluted. I didn't realize you'd come on deck.
Well, I hadn't until this very minute, Whalar said just a bit testily. The Commodore was a solidly built man, his dark hair starting to silver at the temples. There were a few strands of white in his neatly trimmed beard as well, but his dark eyes were sharp and alert. He was accompanied by Father Aubrey Larraise, his chaplain, in the purple, flame-badged cassock of the Order of Schuller.
"Yes, sir, of course you hadn't," Abbat replied quickly.
But his voice still held that same edge of half-apprehensive apology, and he looked so much as if he were planning to salute yet again that Whalar found it difficult not to grimace. He knew he was lucky to have a flag captain of Abbat's experience, but he did wish that, after more than 3,000 miles and 3.5 5-days at sea, the captain would forget he was related, distantly, and only by marriage, to the Earl of Hankey.
"No reason you should have realized I was here until I spoke."
The Commodore tried, mostly successfully, to keep any exaggerated patience out of his tone, and glanced rather pointedly up at the lookout, whose report had summoned him to the deck.
"It sounds like it's probably a Carisian galleon, sir," Abbat said in response to the hint. "The lookout ought to have sighted her sooner, but she's still a good 11 or 12 miles clear. Still, she's close enough for us to get a good look at her canvas, and she's obviously got the new rig. She's also carrying a lot of sail for these weather conditions, and she's making straight for us."
He shrugged very slightly. Given that almost all the armed ships cruising these waters have been Carisian for the better part of a year, I doubt anyone but a Carisian would be making sail to overhaul anyone she hadn't definitely identified as a friend. Whalar nodded slowly as he considered Abbat's analysis of the other galleon captain's thinking. It made sense, he decided, and after 26 years in the Crown service, he had more than enough experience as an officer himself to appreciate what his flag captain had offered about the probable Carisian's thought processes. Unfortunately, he was far less well qualified to evaluate some of the other factors involved in the developing situation, since almost all of his own experience had been ashore, most of it as a cavalry commander in the Imperial Army. As in the majority of Safeholdian realms, traditional Desnarian practice had always been to assign army commanders to its warships, of which it had possessed precious few, each with an experienced seaman to translate his decisions and commands into action. It was a warship commander's job to fight, after all, and a professional military man had more important things to worry about than the technical details of making the boat go where it was supposed to go.
"Or that's the theory, at any rate," Whalar told himself sourly. "And I suppose, if I'm going to be fair, it's always worked well enough against other people who do the same thing. Unfortunately," there was that word again, "Karis doesn't, and it hasn't, not for a long time."
As a loyal subject of Maris IV and an obedient son of Mother Church, Sir Hiram Waller was determined to make a success of his present assignment, but he had few illusions about his own knowledge of things naval. He was out of his depth, he grimaced mentally at his own choice of phrase, as the commander of one of the Navy's new galleons, much less an entire squadron, which was the reason he was so grateful for Abbat's experience. Even if he did want to kick the captain in the arse from time to time.
"You say he's making for us, Captain," Whalar said after a moment. "Do you mean he's pursuing us?"
"Most likely, sir." Abbat swept one arm in a half circle in the general direction of the other ship, still invisible from Archangel Chihiro's deck. "There's a lot of ocean out there, Sir Hiram, and not much shipping on it since the damned Carisians started privateering. It wouldn't be unreasonable for a merchant galleon to be making for Terence Bay just as we are. But as I say, without positively knowing we were friendly, I'd expect any merchant skipper to keep his distance. He'd certainly have reduced sail to maintain our current separation, I'd think, even if he's headed for Silktown or for Kerman Keep like we are. And even though the lookout isn't positive, he thinks this fellow has made more sail.
He isn't positive about something like that?
Whalar raised one eyebrow.
He says he isn't, sir. I can get him down here to speak to you personally, of course.
The flag captain gave another of those small shrugs.
I had Lieutenant Chambers speak with him already, though. It's the lieutenant's opinion that what really caught the lookout's eye in the first place was this other ship setting additional canvas.
I see.
Abbott's response had just neatly encapsulated both his greatest strength and, in Whalar's opinion, his greatest weakness as a flag captain. Or as any sort of military commander, for that matter. From his tone and his body language, he was completely prepared to summon the lookout to the deck so that Whalar could personally browbeat the man. Yet he'd also had Lieutenant Justin Chambers, Archangel Chihiro's second lieutenant, interrogate the sailor first. Chambers was himself an excellent young officer, one Whalar already had an eye on for promotion, and he would have gotten the lookout's very best estimate out of him without intimidating him. It was just like Abbott to have made exactly the right choice about how to get the most accurate information possible, on the one hand, and yet to be willing to allow a possibly irritated superior to vent his spleen on the seaman who'd provided it, on the other. Especially if that superior had the sort of court influence which might benefit his own career.
Be fair, Haram, the Commodore reminded himself for perhaps the thousandth time. Unlike you, Abbott has no connections at all, and the man's already, what, 43? Whatever. Old enough at any rate to expect he's not going to climb much higher without someone to give him a boost. Although I'd think the fact that they picked him to command one of the very first galleons ought to go at least a little way towards reassuring him.
On the other hand, the Navy had never been exactly glamorous in Desnarian eyes. Quite a few of the career naval officers Whalaer had met over the last several months seemed to find it a bit difficult to grasp just how much that was about to change.
All right, Rousseau, he said out loud after several seconds' thought. What do you recommend?
Recommend, sir?
Abbott's eyes flitted sideways for a moment towards Larray's.
Do we let him catch us, or do we make more sail of our own?
Whalar expanded in a slightly dangerous tone. Abbott's eyes came back to the Commodore's face, and Whalar managed not to sigh in exasperation. As far as he could tell, there was nothing at all wrong with Abbott's physical courage. But it was obvious he had no more intention of putting his foot wrong in front of Larray's than he did of offending Whalar himself. Which Whalar was forced to concede upon more mature consideration was probably wise of him in many ways after all. Larray's hadn't been the Commodore's own choice as chaplain. He'd been assigned to Whalar by Bishop Executor Martin Raislayer, and his presence was a clear statement of exactly who Archangel Chihiro actually belonged to. She might fly Desnair's black horse on a yellow field, but there was a reason Mother Church's pennant flew above the national colors. For the moment, no one was talking a great deal about that reason, not openly at any rate, but only a complete moron, which, despite his obsequiousness, Abbott clearly wasn't, could have failed to realize that all the rumors about the imminence of holy war had a very sound basis indeed. It was fortunate, in Whalar's opinion, that there seemed to be little of the fanatic about Father Aubrey. Zealotry, yes, which was only to be expected in the priest the bishop executor had chosen as his personal eyes and ears on Whalar's staff, but not fanaticism. He was unlikely to hold Abbott's honest opinion against the flag captain, whatever it was, but Whalar supposed he shouldn't really blame Abbott for being cautious in front of him.
I suppose, sir, that depends on what it is we want to accomplish, the flag captain said finally. If our sole concern is to collect the bullion from Kerman Keep, then I would advise against accepting action.
His eyes tried to flick to Larray's again, but he kept his voice commendably firm as he continued. While there are two of us and only one of him, it's entirely possible, even probable, that we'd suffer at least some damage even against one of their privateers. If this is one of their war galleons, the chance of that goes up considerably, and any damage we might suffer would have to be put right again before we could sail with the bullion, which would undoubtedly delay its delivery.
A reasonable answer, Waylar reflected, and a well-taken point, for that matter.
He didn't know the precise value of the gold shipment awaiting his two ships, but he knew it was large. In fact, it was a substantial portion of Desnair's annual tithe to Mother Church, actually, which, considering the incredible outlays the temple had been making to pay for the new warships building all over Howard and Haven, lent a certain urgency to getting that gold safely delivered to the temple's coffers in Zion. Vicar Robert's treasury needed all the cash it could get, and given typical winter road conditions, it made sense to send it by sea for as much of its journey as possible. Or it would have, at least, if not for the omnipresent Carisian privateers, and if the ships building in the Gulf of Jarus, conveniently close to Kerman Keep, had been near enough to ready for sea to take it. As it happened, however, those Carisian privateers did indeed seem to be just about everywhere, and none of the new construction at Ithria or Marossa had been far enough advanced for the task, which explained why he and the first two fully operational ships of his squadron had been dispatched all the way from the imperial capital at Desnair the City, so called to distinguish it from the rest of the Empire, to fetch it.
"We're already behind schedule, too, and Bishop Executor Martin won't thank me if I'm even later," he thought. "There are two of us, though, and sooner or later we have to cross swords with them. Langhorne knows the sheer terror of the Carisians' reputation is one of their most effective weapons. Deservedly so, I suppose. But they're only mortals, when all said, and we need to start chipping away at that reputation."
He glanced at his chaplain.
"Father, I'm inclined to let this fine gentleman overhaul us, if that's his intention. Or to let him get at least a bit closer, at any rate. Close enough for us to see who he really is. If he's only a privateer, I imagine he'll sheer off once he realizes he's been chasing a pair of war galleons. And to be honest, I'd like to get him close enough we'd have a chance to catch him if he runs."
"And if he's a war galleon himself, Commodore?"
Larray's deep voice sounded even deeper, coming from someone as youthful-looking as the underpriest, and the brown cockade of his priest's cap fluttered in the stiff breeze, whipping across Archangel Chihiro's quarterdeck.
"If he's a war galleon, then I suppose it's possible he'll keep right on coming," Waylar replied. "If he does, as the captain's just pointed out, there are two of us, which should give us a considerable advantage if we can entice him into engagement range. Do you think His Eminence would be willing to put up with a little delay while we repair any battle damage in return for taking or sinking one of Caleb's warships?"
"Deck there! The nearer chase is shortening sail!"
Captain Sir Duncan Yearley looked up at the mizzen crosstrees and frowned slightly as the announcement came down from above.
"She's taken in a topgallant, sir!" the lookout continued. "Both of 'em are,"
he added a minute or so later, and Yearley's frown deepened. It was merely a thoughtful frown, however, Hector Aplin Armok observed, and set his own mind to following the captain's thoughts. It could be that the other ship had simply decided she was carrying too much sail for safety. The other two galleons had come to a more northerly heading, about north-northwest, and set their topgallants once they realized destiny was pursuing them. But that didn't mean their commander had been happy about his own decision. His ship's rigs might be considerably more powerful than they would have been 2 or 3 years ago, but very few vessels in the world had sail plans as powerful and well-balanced as those of the present Carisian Navy.
Destiny's masts were taller, proportionately, and included the lofty royal masts her quarry lacked. Yet it wasn't simply a matter of more mast height, either. If she'd set every scrap of canvas she had, including all her fore and aft staysails and all three jibs, she would have shown 25 sails. Not only that, the new water-powered Carisian looms meant her sails had a much tighter weave, which let them capture more of the wind's power, and they were cut to the new flat pattern Sir Dustin Oliver had introduced. The ships she was pursuing didn't carry royals or staysails. They would have shown only 10 under the same circumstances. Those sails were still cut to the old bag sail pattern, acting like rounded sacks to catch the wind, rather than the flatter, more perpendicular, and hence more efficient surface of Destiny's. Hector had to admit that the bag sails looked as if they should have been more powerful, but the superiority of Oliver's new patterns had been conclusively demonstrated in competitive sailing tests in Howell Bay. The proportions of the other ship's sails were significantly different as well, for Destiny's topsails had both a greater hoist and a broader head, which gave each of them significantly more area and made them more powerful. In fact, her topsails were actually her principal sails, whereas the courses set below them remained the primary sails for the ships she was pursuing. Of course, there was a vast difference between the total canvas a ship could set under optimum conditions and the amount it was safe to carry in any given sea state. In some respects, in fact, Destiny and her sisters were actually oversparred. It would have been easy to set too much sail, driver too hard, even dangerously too hard, under the wrong circumstances. Besides, there was a point at which crowding on more sail actually slowed a ship by driving her head too deeply into the sea, or heeling her so sharply it distorted the water flow around her hull, even if it didn't actually endanger her. So, in most respects, how many sails a ship had mattered less than the total sail area she could show under the current strength of wind and wave. But it did matter how that area was distributed because of how it affected the ship's motion. At the moment, for example, one reason Captain Yearley had set the fore course was that unlike the ship's other square sails, the fore course actually tended to lift the bow slightly, easing the vessel's motion, rather than driving the bow down deeper and harder. A captain had to think about the blanketing effect of his sails as well, and generally speaking, the higher a sail, the greater its heeling effect. So, in heavy weather, the standard order of reducing sail would be to take in first the royals, assuming the ship carried them in the first place, then the topgallants, the courses, and finally the topsails. The courses came off before the higher topsails because of their greater size and the difficulty in handling them, despite the greater heeling effect of the topsails. Hector's own initial estimate that the other galleons were as large as Destiny appeared to have been in error, too. The other ships were at least a little smaller than he'd thought, although not greatly so, which meant Destiny could safely carry more canvas than they could under these conditions. Captain Yearley had been doing just that, having shaken out his reefs and set the fore course. The main course was brailed up to keep it from blanketing the foremast, with the wind dead aft on her new course. And even without her own royals, Destiny's speed had risen to almost 8 knots. She'd been steadily overhauling the other vessels for the past 5 hours now, despite the fact that they'd both put on extra sail of their own once they finally noticed they were being pursued, so it was certainly possible, likely in fact, the chases had decided they couldn't outrun Destiny after all. And if that was the case, there was no point in their risking damage to sails or rigging by carrying too much canvas. Particularly not since it was always possible something would carry away aloft in Destiny, in which case they might be able to outsail her yet. On the other hand, the topgallants would have been the first sails to be furled, if a captain decided to shorten for any reason, not simply because of weather concerns. So it was also possible the other ships had simply decided to allow destiny to overtake them, which would require either a very stupid merchant skipper, given the depredations of Carisian privateers and naval cruisers, or else a...
"I believe we'll clear the ship for action in about another 3 hours, I think, Master Lathic," Yearly said calmly. "We'll be coming up on lunch shortly, I believe, so there's no point rushing things. But see to it all hands get something hot to eat, and plenty of it, if you please."
"Aye, sir," the First Lieutenant acknowledged. He beckoned to one of the midshipmen and started giving the lad crisp instructions, and Yearly glanced at Hector.
"You don't think they're merchantmen after all, do you, sir?" Hector asked quietly.
Some captains would have bitten the head off of any officer, be he ever so well connected to the aristocracy, for having the impertinence to ask him such a question uninvited. Hector wasn't concerned about that, though, and not because of his own noble title.
"No, Master Aplanarmak, I don't," Yearly replied.
He nodded ahead to where the other ship's sails were visible now from the deck as Destiny rose with the waves.
"Both those fellows are inviting us to catch up with them, and no merchant skipper would do that, even if they haven't seen our colors by now, which they well may not have."
He glanced up to where the Empire's banner streamed out, stiff and hard-looking, from the mizzen yard. On Destiny's new course, running almost directly before the wind as she charged after the other ships, it was entirely possible that her colors were hidden from her quarry by the canvas on her foremast and mainmast.
"They may not realize we're a king ship, I mean an emperor ship," Yearly grimaced as he made the self-correction. "But they have to assume we're at least a privateer. Under the circumstances, merchant vessels would go right on running for all they were worth in hopes of staying away from us until dark. Mind you, I don't think they'd succeed, but they might, and no one ever knows what the wind's going to do."
He paused, one eyebrow raised, and Hector recognized the cue.
"So if they aren't running as hard as they can, if they've decided they want us to catch up with them while we'll both have daylight still in hand, you think they're war galleons too, sir?" he said.
"I think that's very likely, Master Aplanarmak," Yearly nodded slightly,
with the satisfaction of a teacher whose student had drawn the proper conclusion.
"I'd thought for a moment, before they both shortened, that it might be a merchant with an escort dropping astern of the ship under his protection. But no escort would be foolish enough to keep his charge in close company if he decided to drop back to engage us. So it seems to me we have to assume they're both warships. According to Baron Wave Thunder's latest estimates, Desnair should have at least a dozen of their converted galleons about ready for sea. There's no way to be positive yet, but I'll be quite surprised if these aren't two of them. The only question in my mind," the captain continued, his voice becoming a bit dreamy as his eyes unfocused in thought, "is what two of them would be doing out here by themselves."
"They might simply be working up, sir," Hector suggested diffidently, and Yearly nodded.
"Indeed they might, but not this far out to sea, I'm thinking."
He indicated the brisk wind, the motion of the hard-driven ship, with a twitch of his head.
"These conditions are a bit lively for a lubberly lot like the Desnarian Navy, wouldn't you say, Master Aplanarmak? I'd expect them to stay closer to home if all they're after is sail drill, especially if there are only two of them. We're a good 650 leagues from their shipyards at Geira, and over 100 leagues off Hened Head, for that matter. It's possible they're from the ships building in the Gulf of Jarrus instead of the Geira yards. God knows they're building a lot more of their total navy in the Gulf than they are at Geira. But even that would be an awful long way to come just to drill their crews, and I'd think Baron Jarrus would be a tad nervous about having just two of his meet a squadron or two of our galleons when they decided to venture out into deeper water. He's certainly been cautious enough about things like that so far, at least. So I wonder."
The captain stood thinking for several more moments, then nodded again, this time obviously to himself, before he glanced once more at the youthful ensign standing beside him.
"I can think of one good reason for them to be here, Master Aplin Armak," he said with a slight smile. "And if I'm right, the men are going to be just a bit unhappy that we sighted them when we did, instead of a few days later."
"Sir?"
Hector suppressed an urge to scratch his head in puzzlement, and Yerli's smile broadened.
"Now then, Master Aplin Armak, a captain has to maintain at least a few little secrets, don't you think?"
"Excuse me, sir."
Captain Abbott turned, raising one eyebrow, to face Lieutenant Lazer Martinson, Archangel Chihiro's first lieutenant.
"Yes, Lazer, what is it?"
Abbott's tone was a bit brusque. He and Martinson normally got along quite well, but at the moment, as the pursuing vessel's lower masts began to loom above the horizon, even from deck level, the captain had a few things on his mind. The distance to the other ship was down to little more than 7 miles, and given their present speeds, she would be up to Archangel Chihiro in no more than 2 or 2.5 hours. For that matter, she'd be into extreme gunshot in little more than 90 minutes.
"Master Chambers!"
Martinson twitched his head slightly in the direction of the mizzentop, where Lieutenant Chambers was ensconced, watching the other ship.
"Reports that he's just seen her colors, sir. She's flying the Carisian banner and a commission streamer."
Abbott's expression tightened ever so slightly. Only someone who knew the captain well would have noticed, but Martinson did know him well, and he also knew exactly what Abbott was thinking. The fact that Chambers had finally seen the colors, which had been masked by her canvas, only confirmed the captain's previous near certainty that she had to be Carisian. But the commission streamer, that was something else entirely. No privateer would have been flying that. Only ships of the Royal Carisian Navy, or rather, the Imperial Carisian Navy these days, flew those.
"I see," Abbott said after a moment. "And has he had an opportunity to estimate her force?"
"We've not seen her ports yet, sir, but she's carrying at least 10 or 12 of their short guns on her weather deck. Probably more. And,"
Martinson added almost apologetically,
"Master Chambers says she doesn't look merchant-built to him."
The tightening around the captain's eyes was more noticeable this time. If Chambers' estimates were correct, and the second lieutenant was quite a competent officer, then their pursuer wasn't simply an Imperial warship, but one of the Carisian Navy's new, purpose-built galleons, whereas both of Willar's ships were converted merchant vessels.
"I see," Abbott repeated, nodding to his first officer. "Thank you, Master Martinson."
Martinson touched his chest in salute, then withdrew to the larboard side of the quarterdeck, while Abbott clasped his hands behind his back and turned to the rail, gazing out across the crested waves in obvious thought. The lieutenant didn't envy his captain at the moment. On the other hand, he didn't feel an enormous amount of sympathy either. For the most part, he respected Abbott as a seaman, although for all his years of naval service, the captain had precious little experience with galleons. Virtually all of his previous time had been served aboard the Desnarian Navy's limited number of galleys, and his ship-handling skills, while adequate, weren't as good as Martinson's own. In fact, that was one reason Martinson had been assigned as his first lieutenant. In terms of military experience, though, Abbott was far more qualified to command than Martinson was, and the lieutenant knew it. Of course, no one in Desnarian service had any experience at all in broadside gunnery tactics, but at least Abbott had smelled powder smoke in actual combat, which was more than Martinson had. Given that experience, Abbott had to be, or damned well ought to be at any rate, even better aware of the looming confrontation's balance of combat power than Martinson was. Not to mention the minor fact that an officer with his experience should, perhaps, have been just a bit more careful about spent a little more time thinking over what he had recommended to Commodore Whalar. At first glance, Whalar's two ships ought to have had the advantage. There were two of them, after all. But that wasn't all that was involved here, not by a long shot. One of the Carizian Navy's new galleons would mount at least 50 guns, and probably more, to Archangel Chihiro's 40. Worse, they'd be heavier guns. Archangel Chihiro, like her consort, Blessed Warrior, carried 26 lizards on her gun deck, and 14 falcons on her upper deck. That might seem to give her 80% of the Carizians' broadside, and all of their guns not only had the new trunnions and carriages, but used the new bagged powder charges the Carizians had introduced, so they ought to be able to match the other ship's rate of fire as well. So far, all well and good, Martinson thought dryly. But the lizard's round shot weighed only a bit over 20 pounds each, and the falcons weighed less than 9, while, if the reports about the Carizians were correct, the other ship would mount long 30-pounders on her gun deck and short 30-pounders, what the Carizians called carronades, on her upper deck, which would give her over twice Archangel Chihiro's weight of metal. In fact, she'd carry a heavier weight of broadside than both the Desnarian ships combined in a much more heavily framed and planked hull. And that changed Abbott's earlier calculations significantly. Not only would each hit be far more destructive than he almost certainly had been expecting, but her heavier hull would take substantially less damage from each hit she received in return. Of course, two lighter ships, if well handled, ought to be able to outmaneuver a single opponent, and it was extremely unlikely the Carizian carried a big enough crew to fully man both broadsides, especially if she had to reserve hands to manage her own sails. If they could get to grips with her from both sides simultaneously, they ought to be able to overpower her in fairly short order. But while the sail-handling skills of Archangel Chihiro's crew had improved hugely since they'd left Desnair the city, Martinson very strongly doubted they could even come close to an experienced Carizian crew's level of competence. He felt fairly confident that, since the other ship had been cruising alone, with no one else in company with her, Abbott had assumed she was most likely a privateer, not a regular man-of-war. It would have been a reasonable enough assumption in many ways, and had it proved accurate, she would have been far more lightly gunned, while the quality of her ship's company would have been much more problematical as well. Besides, privateers weren't in the business of taking hard knocks if they could avoid it. If a privateer skipper had realized he was pursuing two Desnarian warships rather than a pair of fat merchant prizes, he would almost certainly have decided his time could be more profitably spent elsewhere. A Carizian Navy captain was likely to feel a bit differently about that. But just how does the captain break the news to the Commodore? Martinson wondered a bit sardonically. Excuse me, Commodore, but it turns out that's a war galleon back there instead, and I'm just a bit less confident about beating her than I was about beating a privateer. The lieutenant snorted mentally. Sure, I can just hear him saying that. No, Abbott wasn't going to risk pissing Whalar off by turning cautious at this point. And since Whalar lacked the seagoing experience to realize exactly how weight of metal and, especially, relative ship-handling skills really factored into a sea battle, it was unlikely he was going to recognize just how dicey this entire situation could turn. He certainly wasn't going to decide to try avoiding action at this point, not without Abbott suggesting it, at any rate. Which meant things were going to get just a bit lively in the next 2 hours or so. Sir Duncan Yearley gazed ahead at the towering canvas of the Desnarian ships and scratched his chin thoughtfully. As always, the prospect of battle created a hollow, unsettled feeling in his belly. None of his officers and men appeared to share his apprehension, and it was, of course, unthinkable for him to reveal it to them. He often wondered if he was truly fundamentally different from them in that regard, or if they were simply better at hiding their emotions than he was. Not that it mattered at the moment.
"Well," he remarked out loud, permitting neither his voice nor his expression to hint at any internal trepidation. "At least they seem to have figured out we're not just some deaf, dumb, and blind merchant ship."
The men manning the quarterdeck carronades heard him, as he'd intended, and grinned. Some of them nudged each other in amusement, and a couple actually chuckled. No sign they felt anything but confident anticipation.
"Cheerful idiots, aren't they?"
Yearly thought, but there was as much affectionate amusement of his own as exasperation in the reflection. He pushed the thought aside as he reconsidered his position. He was confident he had an accurate appraisal of the other ship's armament now, and he rather wished he'd been up against a few less guns. His own were heavier, and he had no doubt his gun crews were far more experienced and almost certainly better drilled into the bargain. But 80 guns were still 80 guns, and he had only 54.
"I wonder if that's a galley commander over there," he mused.
It could well make a difference, given the habits of thought involved. Galley captains thought in terms of head-on approaches, since their chase armament, which always mounted the heaviest guns, fired only directly ahead, and boarding tactics. And a galley captain would almost certainly be less skilled when it came to maneuvering a fundamentally clumsy thing like a square-rigged galleon. Besides, galleys had oars. Captains accustomed to being able to row directly into the wind tended to have a less lively appreciation for the value of the weather gauge. Yearly stopped scratching his chin and clasped his hands behind him, his expression distant as he contemplated the narrowing stretch of water between Destiny and her adversaries. The Desnarians weren't quite in line. The wind had backed about 5 points from south-southeast to east-southeast during the long hours since the chase had begun, and the rearmost of the two ships was a good 200 yards to leeward and astern of her consort as they sailed along on the starboard tack. Yearly wondered if that was intentional or simply sloppy station keeping, or, for that matter, if it simply represented lack of experience on his opponent's part. The Desnarian Empire did still follow the tradition of putting army officers in charge of warships, after all.
"Let's not get too overconfident in that respect, Duncan," he reminded himself. "Still, we can hope, can't we?"
200 yards might not sound like an enormous distance to a landsman, but Yearly was no landsman. To an artillerist accustomed to thinking in terms of land battles fought on nice, motionless pieces of dirt, 200 yards would equate to easy canister range, where it would be difficult for any semi-competent gun crew to miss a target 50-plus yards long, 6 or 7 yards high, and the next best thing to 10 yards wide. For a seaman, accustomed to the fact that his gun platform was likely to be moving in at least 3 different directions simultaneously, completely irrespective of his target's motion, a 200-yard range was something else entirely.
"Like a perfectly good range to completely waste powder and shot at," the captain thought dryly. "Which means those two fellows over there are out of effective support range of one another. Unless I am obliging enough to sail directly between them, at any rate."
He glanced up at his own sails and decided.
"Master Lathic."
"Yes, sir."
"Let's get the T'Gallant's offer, if you please."
"Aye, aye, sir."
The first lieutenant touched his chest in salute, then raised his leather speaking trumpet.
"Hands to reduce sail,"
he bellowed through it, and feet thundered across the deck planking in response. Lazer Martinson watched the Carizian through narrow eyes from his station on Archangel Chihiro's quarterdeck. She was sweeping steadily closer, with her starboard battery run out while she angled toward Archangel Chihiro's larboard quarter, which didn't surprise Martinson a great deal.
It didn't please him, but it didn't surprise him either. The one thing of which he was completely confident was that Caleb Armach wasn't in the habit of assigning his most powerful warships to people who didn't know what to do with them, and that Carizian captain over there obviously recognized the huge maneuver advantage his possession of the weather gauge bestowed upon him. Because of his position to windward, the choice of when and how to initiate action lay completely in his hands, and he clearly understood exactly what to do with that advantage. Martinson only wished he was more confident that Captain Abbott understood the same thing. Whether Abbott understood that or not, it was already painfully evident to Martinson that the Carizian galleon was being far more ably handled than his own ship. Archangel Chihiro's sail drill had improved immeasurably during her lengthy voyage from Desnair. Despite that, however, the precision of the other ship's drill as she reduced canvas only underscored how far Archangel Chihiro's own company still had to go. The Carizian's forecourse was brailed up, and her topgallants disappeared with mechanical precision, as if whisked away by the wave of a single wizard's magic wand. Two of her jibs disappeared as well, as she reduced to fighting sail, yet even with her sail area drastically reduced, she continued to forge steadily closer. Her speed had dropped with the reduction of sail, but that didn't make Martinson a lot happier. Archangel Chihiro and Blessed Warrior had taken in their own courses in preparation for battle, and that had cost them even more speed than the Carizian had given up. She still had an advantage of close to 2 knots, and she was only 800 yards astern. In 15 minutes, give or take, she'd be right alongside, and it was evident what her captain had in mind. He intended to keep to leeward of Archangel Chihiro, engaging her larboard broadside with his own starboard guns. With the shift in the wind, both ships were heeling harder now, so his shots might tend to go high, but it would allow him to engage the flagship in isolation, where Blessed Warrior would be unable to engage him closely. In a straight broadside duel, the heavier Carizian galleon would almost certainly overpower Archangel Chihiro in relatively short order.
Still, if the captain and the Commodore's plans work out, it won't be a straight broadside duel, now will it?
No, it wouldn't. Unfortunately, Lieutenant Martinson suspected that Carizian captain over there might just have a few plans of his own.